Welcome to the Brett Boone Podcast. Explore the mind of MLB All-Star, Silver Slugger, and Gold Glove winner, Brett Boone, as he sits down with his friends from the world of professional sports. Now up to bat, Brett Boone.
Welcome to the Brett Boone Podcast. I am Brett Boone. Today on the program, I got a four-time Pro Bowler. He was the MVP in 1988. And you can listen to him daily on WFAN and WFAN in New York, Boomer and Geo Morning Show. In October, he's being inducted into the Radio Hall of Fame. A lot of credentials for my guest today. Ladies and gentlemen, Boomer Esiason. Boomer, I appreciate you coming on.
My pleasure, Brett. Thanks for having me on. And listen, you go way back just like I do. I think we probably had some of our careers paralleling each other. I know that you played in Cincinnati. Of course, I cover your brother here every day, unfortunately, as a non-Yankee fan. I got to talk the Yankee fan off the ledge. But yeah, it's great to be with you.
That's funny, because until Aaron took that job, I can't stand the Yankees. A lot of heartbreak in that city for me over the years, you know, those great Yankee teams of the late 90s and early 2000s, I had to deal with them. So I got a bad taste in my mouth, but, you know, family calls. So I'm a semi-Yankee fan.
Let me ask you this question. Can I ask you a question first?
Absolutely.
I'm wondering how much you and your brother discuss, like, what he's doing now, and not for you to give me any or divulge any right private information, but do you guys talk a lot during the year?
Okay, it goes in waves. When he first started doing it, we talked quite a bit. And, you know, because I was interested how he was going about it, I'd call him up and say, hey, you might want to do this and that, and really consider the mental side and your interaction in that one-on-one relationship with your players. Cause I, as a player, I knew how important that was, how the skipper interacted with me and how he did certain things. And there was always a reason behind it. So we'd talk a little bit as he moved on into the job. We talk, you know, as brothers, we probably talk weekly anyway. It's just during the season. Like right now, I'm going to kind of stay away from him. The Yankees aren't doing very well. I don't want to be on the flip side. If he's winning, I stay away from him too, because I do not want to be blamed for a loss, or you know, flipping the script. A year ago, I went back on the field in Texas and did the hitting coach job for the Rangers, and that was a different level because, you know, you play a long time. I've been in this game my whole life, but until you put the uniform on and coach at that level, you really can't know what those guys are going through. And I learned a lot. My eyes were opened. Since then I've apologized to every coach or manager I ever played for, because I just didn't know. And it was interesting. Now our talks went from once a week to we were talking 3-4 times a week. And he goes, you know, he'd call me, how's it going? I'd be like, this is unbelievable what we deal with. And he's laughing like, yeah, you know, because as a big brother, you know, I could call and give him advice and say, you know, from the outside, Aaron, just do this and do it's simple. You know, I'm sitting at home in Del Mar. All of a sudden, put yourself in that position where you're in charge of 13 hitters and they're just, you're pulling your hair out every night. You know, I'm laying in bed at night thinking, how can I say the right words to get Ezekiel Duran to get a hit tomorrow? And that's why I'm not sleeping. So it was interesting being in that arena, getting a little bit of a grasp on what these guys go through on a daily basis. But yeah, I mean, that's the longest answer ever to your question, but we still do talk weekly. And sometimes we talk about the kids and actually most of the time we'll touch on baseball. We'll touch on what the Yankees are doing. We'll touch on teams around the game. And then, you know, it's pretty much how are the kids doing, mom and dad, that type of stuff.
Yeah, well, you get to talk to him directly. I have to talk to his fan base, or lack thereof, depending on where the Yankees are in their season. And as you know, right now, they're in a downturn, and an ugly one at that. And you know, the strikeouts are just mounting, and the last three games have been horrific against the Rays. I just can't even imagine what it must be like for not only the hitting coach, but for the manager who has guys like Paul Goldschmidt, Cody Bellinger, Jason Dominguez, Anthony Volpe, who I know he loves, Jazz Chisholm. And these guys all have gone cold at the same time over these last 20 games. And I try to educate the fan that it's not all that easy to sit a guy down and start screaming at him because you're dealing with him for a 162-game season plus spring training. So you're trying to manage all these different relationships that have to be really, they just have to be really difficult for the manager.
And, that's the one thing I've watched Aaron through the year. He does a really good job with that. He really does a good job with managing personalities, which managing egos. You know, as well as me as a player, that relationship with your head coach, with my manager. You see the great ones and you see the guys that aren't so great. And it's a hug for one guy. It's a kick in the ass for another guy to get the same result. And I think Aaron really manages that and does a good job. I used the example of, and I'm sure you saw this a couple of weeks ago, with Jazz Chisholm's got the lollipop in his mouth.
Yes.
At a pretty, if they've just won 12 in a row and Jazz is going off to the All-Star game, and not saying it's okay to do that, it's different. But when you're in the middle of a battle and it's almost like he put the lollipop in his mouth just so everybody would talk about the lollipop in his mouth. And the way Aaron has nurtured that relationship between him and Jazz, and he reacted and said it pissed him off. And I think Jazz backed off right away and said, if Aaron to come out and say that to me with the relationship we have, I was in the wrong, and corrected it, and there was no problem after that. I think that's years of developing relationship with his players, and I think that's Aaron's strong suit. Is he really, those guys in that locker room truly love him and respect him, and I think that's pretty much the whole battle of managing at this level is getting the respect of your play. It doesn't mean you have to be best friends all the time, because that's the great ones I've played for. I'm pissed at half the time, and they push the right buttons for my personality. So I've watched them over the years, and I've really gained a lot of respect. And I know, especially in New York, and as well as anybody, New Yorkers, as great as a city that is, and I love nothing more than coming to New York to play, to listen to those fans, for them to yell at me, rip me, boo me. It's the greatest sports city in the world. That being said, they are delusional. They think it's 1946 and the Bronx Bombers are chasing 10 in a row. And it's like, it's 2026. That doesn't happen anymore. There's a little more parity in sports. But to those Yankee fans, you always hear the world, anything short of the World Series is just, it's a failure. And I'm like, what world are we living in? That doesn't happen anymore, but that's what makes New York great.
Yeah, but it also makes it tough. And I'm glad you brought up the Jazz Chisholm situation with that lollipop, because these things around here tend to get really, really blown out of proportion. And sometimes it could cost the manager his job, a head coach for a football team his job, depending on how he is perceived by the fans. And the one thing I will give Aaron a lot of credit, he's always remained relatively calm through the roughest of waters, if you will. I remember when he had Gleyber Torres, and Gleyber Torres wasn't running down the first base. He wasn't running out ground balls. And, that became an issue. And then there was the Gary Sanchez issue. And then there was all these different things that have happened over the year. And because of the passionate fan base here in New York, and the Yankees have the biggest fan base and most passionate and most entitled, they tend to scream about everything. And for all of it, to say, that he has been an upstanding professional face of the franchise would be an understatement, because he's done even more than that. So he's been calm through these rough waters for sure. I know they'll come out of it. The American League's not great. They'll get Aaron Judge back at some point, and they do have a pitching staff that can go very deep into the playoffs. And if we are sitting here now in July talking about the July and June swoon that they're having, I guarantee you in September and October, we'll be talking about the playoffs and how loaded they are, because Brian Cashman will definitely add to this roster.
I agree. And you got Freed waiting in the wings to come back. You got a Schmidt. Oh, yeah. You've got, hopefully, Stanton comes back at some point. You know, Ben Rice has had a great year for him. Bellinger's not going to be like this for the rest of the season. I think what Goldschmidt gave you to date is exceeded expectations, and all of a sudden he's on this downturn. But he wasn't even counted on to be one of the main guys. So I think you're right. I think with the American League, the parity, and I've never seen anything like it, Boomer, this year in the American League. The way everybody, you talk about, okay, now we've got to go through these tough cities. I look at the American League outside of Tampa Bay and the Yankees up until this recent skid. There are no tough cities to go through in the American League. Everybody's 500 ball club. So I think you're right. As mediocre as the American League is this year, the way the Yankees have had this little bit of a cushion where they got to 10 games over 500, you can absorb this a little bit.
Yeah,
and I think they're going to be a playoff team.
Yeah, I also say that, you know, they have $90 million on the injured list. So
it's not absolutely
as if the $350 million Yankees are playing against the $140 million Rays. I mean, you're missing your most key aspect of your team, your top left-handed pitcher, your number two hitter who hits 50 home runs, and you have a guy that when Stanton is in the middle of the lineup, and you know better than I would, extends the lineup, makes everybody, you know, worry about the other. You know, the other players benefit from those guys being there because those guys create so many problems. So, and that's what's missing. That's why they get off to a good start. They're healthy. Judge and Rice were a 1-2 combination at the beginning of the year. Goldschmidt fed off of that. But now you have a 38-year-old at the end of his career, and you're asking him to play every single day. And it's showing up, not in the field, but it's certainly showing up at the plate.
Yo, it's Jey Uso from WWE.
And I'm Jimmy Uso.
Chumba Casino and WWE are hyped for the biggest event of the summer, SummerSlam.
I know, I can't wait.
There's nothing better to do while we're waiting
than playing Chumba Casino.
Sign up today and you could win a VIP experience
with Chumba Casino and WWE for SummerSlam.
So what are you waiting for?
Play Chumba Casino
and enter for your chance to win.
Let's Chumba.
Yeah. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Yeah, I think it's a good point on Stanton. You're right. His presence makes the difference in that lineup. And then Aaron Judge, who is the best offensive player in all of baseball. You know, that makes a little bit difference when the best player in the world offensively is not in the lineup. And hopefully they get back him back soon. But yeah, it's going to be an interesting run. But I think with all that you hear on a daily basis, because New York and the way it is, I think if you look at the dartboard, they're in pretty good shape where they are right now. I wanted to talk, it's All-Star time. And I wanted to talk about all four sports and how they go about it. You know, football's kind of uncled it and we're playing flag football now. But if you look at the four, who does it right? Who does the All-Star game best?
Well, you know, I think, you know, well, as I've gotten older, I've kind of got lost the kind of glimmer that the All-Star game brought. But when I think about who does it right, baseball's still baseball. They still play the game. And the pitchers want to go out there and they want to strike out the batters. And they're only usually pitching one, maybe two innings at most. And they usually give you their best effort because they don't want to be embarrassed. So I would say the number one All-Star game would be Major League Baseball, because they don't deviate from what the game really is. Now, they do some of the stuff around it, like the home run hitting contest and things of that nature. But, you know, the NHL's tried to juice it up by doing three-on-threes and trying to do by countries and different ways of doing things. The NBA is a joke. The NFL turned into be a joke. You know, I played in four Pro Bowls, and in those Pro Bowls, they used to kill the quarterback because the defensive lineman always wanted the MVP. So there was an incentive for them to hurt us. So I would say baseball still does it right, and it still has a little bit of a luster to it and still feels pretty good.
Do you like how do you think they have the system right? How you become an All-Star? Let's just isolate baseball for a minute and think, because you see every year, and every year there's going to be snubs, and every year there's going to be guys that should be there that aren't. There's guys that are there that shouldn't be. And that's life. And that's what we go through. I I kind of now as ex player and someone that has to talk about it, I look at it and it's like, you know, I always like to get it right. I like if you earn the right to be an all-star, yep, you're there. And if you don't, you're not. Well, that's in a perfect world. That would be my formula, but it's not a perfect world. So guys get voted in that really have no business being there this year. And then you got guys sitting at home. You know, we saw Wheeler, the Phillies number one pitcher the other day, having a problem with him not going to the All-Star game. Now, I don't think you have to advocate for yourself. I think you let your teammates do that. But it's obvious Wheeler should be there. A Sonny Gray should be at the All-Star game. We know that. The players know that. And I think if the players had the vote, they pretty much are the ones that know who should be there and who should. That being said, it is the fans' game. And they're the guys that buy the tickets and go to the ballpark. So I think they should have a say. In baseball, the fans pick the starters. Is that the best formula, or for Boomer Esiason, would you do it different?
Well, you know, I think since the fans are invested in the game, and I know the media is invested in the game too when it comes to the Hall of Fame, that's one of the reasons why, you know, the Hall of Fame selections all get written about as much as they do, because they're smart. All the Hall of Fames get the media involved and they want it to be discussed because they want their sport to be spoken about. As far as the All-Star games are concerned, I know Luke Weaver probably for the Mets should be there. Wheeler's not there for a different reason, because he can't pitch, I guess, because of where he is in his rotation. That's how I understood it. And I think that's ridiculous, because he's had a great first half of the season. He should be there. He should be able to participate, even though he's not going to play in the game. So, I don't know if that's a money thing. I don't know if that's something that Major League Baseball is just – you know, started to come out with. But, you know, I would say 95% of the guys that are there deserve to be there. There's usually going to be that 4-5% that probably should not be there. There's always going to be controversy. Somebody's always going to be left off for different reasons. And I don't necessarily know anybody really understands how good of a season Luke Weaver has had for the Mets, because the Mets have been so abysmal. So the fact that Juan Soto is going there representing the Mets, I guess, is probably enough. But I don't think there's ever going to be a perfect system, but I think it's probably about as good as it can get.
What about every team? You think every team? I've always had a problem with this. I said, if you're an all-star, you're an all-star, and you earn to put that on your resume. In Major League Baseball, every team has to be represented, and I've always had a problem with that, because I thought, well, why should you be an all-star? Because you're the best of the worst of the lot. And it's like, I understand from a PR standpoint, it's like, yep, no, we need to have, you know, who's the team this year? We need to have a Rocky on the team. And now I'm not saying a Rocky shouldn't be at an all-star game, but if you just have a team that you look up and down, it says nobody's really an all-star, but we have to pick somebody. I've always had a little bit of a problem with that. Like, he shouldn't be allowed to put that on his resume.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Like, we were just talking about the Mets, and how about the Royals and the Mets are two of the worst teams in the league, yet they have some of the best players in the league on their team. And both Bobby Witt Jr., I believe, is an all-star, so is Juan Soto, and they deserve to be there.
Absolutely.
And that, you know, and not because they have to represent each, you know, one has to represent their club. They're playing as if they should be there. So, yeah, I feel like that's a little bit of a Little League tendency. If you remember when we played back in Little League, every team had to be represented in the All-Star game. Yeah. And I remember a couple of my teammates that didn't make it because of that rule. Yeah, I think you should be rewarded for what you have done on the field, not because you're the best player on the worst team. So I'm in agreement with you there, but I also understand the PR angle of it, because I remember as a kid, when I was growing up, I used to love the All-Star game because I wanted to see my team, the Mets, represented there. And that was really cool to see, you know, when the Mets were good back in the early 70s and late 60s. We had a bunch of guys that would play in the All-Star game, and I always look forward to seeing them out there doing their best and representing our team.
You mentioned the Hall of Fame. Let's turn it to the Hall of Fame. Football Hall of Fame, Baseball Hall of Fame. I think the Football Hall of Fame, for me, does it better. You get the writers in a room, you have to debate it. Whereas the baseball is more of a ballot. I think, and I'm not saying the majority of writers, and I don't think this by any means, but I think some writers have an agenda. I think it's different. You look at the two, what do you think is the best Hall of Fame, and who does it right when it comes to get inducting those guys. Now baseball's extended there. Now we have separate, you know, separate ways that you can get into the hall. And I think that's good because not everybody gets it right in the beginning. And I think years go by and you look at certain guys' body of work and you say, you know, we missed it on him. So I think it's good to have a second chance seeing guys get in. I just personally, I saw a guy that I played against for a lot of years at my position, Jeff Kent. And I've been kind of advocating for him for years. I said, how can this guy get 15% of the vote? What are you seeing that I didn't see? He hit more home runs than anyone in the history of my position. He's in the top five of every category. He drove in 1,700 runs as a second baseman when driving in runs was a thing. And finally, he got inducted from the Veterans Committee. But nevertheless, he's in the hall. And I think that righted a wrong for me. So I like what they're doing as far as other ways to get in. But I don't know if we have the perfect system for the initial 4 years out of the game. Now you're eligible in the way we go about it. I like football's way a little bit better. Your thoughts?
You know, as far as football is concerned, I think the smaller the group of people that are making the votes, the more likely they are to be biased or can be pushed by one person or another to get them into the Hall of Fame. And I have advocated for a number of players to be in the Hall of Fame, and a couple of guys have gotten there and a couple of guys have not gotten there. So the guy I replaced in Cincinnati was a guy by the name of Ken Anderson. And Ken Anderson played 16 years in the NFL, and at one point in time, he was the only quarterback that completed 70% of his passes during a season. And that was back when the defenses could hold and the game was completely different and we weren't thrown 50 times a game. So, you know, I advocated for him. I advocated for Joe Klecko, who finally got in. He didn't have the premier stats because they weren't keeping stats, and only the people who could play against him could truly understand the impact that he would have on the game that you would be in. So I would advocate for him. I've advocated for other players. I still think there isn't a perfect way of doing it. And because we do have a recency bias, when you look back at different eras, the numbers aren't going to be the same. So, you know, for our sport, the offensive numbers have exploded over the last 20 years because the rules have changed. So when you go back and you look at Kenny Anderson's, you know, statistics, you're saying, well, he doesn't belong in the end. And, you know, the Hall of Fame, look at these guys that are going in now, like Drew Brees is going in this year, who certainly belongs there. Peyton Manning went in, Tom Brady's going in. I mean, they all have these incredibly inflated numbers because they played in a completely different game than we played way back when in the 50s, 60s, 70s and 80s. Even the 90s were still a struggle. It wasn't until the middle 2000s where the rules really started to change to favor the offense. So it's unfortunate that it's such a small group of guys that wields as much power as they do. So I'm not a big fan of the way that we do it either. And again, like I said, I don't know if there is a perfect way. I still think there has to be a media component because you need the promotion. But there really should be more of a football component, more ex-general managers, more ex-players, and more ex-coaches that really knew the game and know who the greatest players that have ever played should be the ones that get elected in my eyes.
Yeah, I think you're right. There is no, I've racked my brain about this. What would be the perfect system? I can't really come up with it. I think as players, and I'm just biased, I think, but I think as players, the guys that I played against, the guys that you played against, you have a pretty good idea that guy's a Hall of Famer, that guy's not. But the numbers and how they change over the generations, you know, you made examples of football, how it's changed. Baseball, same thing. In my generation, it was average. It was home runs. It was RBIs. That's how we got paid. How many runs did I drive in 100 this year? It's not that anymore. It's OPS. For pitchers, it's not about how many games did you win anymore. So class in 2026, it's not fair to judge them against Roger Clemens for how many wins you have. That's not what the game's about. Pitchers are, they don't go as long and the win isn't the thing. It's more of an ERA thing. So I agree with you. You have to vote for the generation and the players that you played against in that generation. It's just a tricky way. How do you do that? I've thought about, okay, if a guy's going in, his last year was 2010. You get, you throw out and you get as many players. You have to have played a certain amount of time and a certain amount of time against said player that's being voted on. So you're going to have all these separate committees. But if you get 30 or 40 guys that played with the current inductee for 8 or more years, you're going to have a pretty accurate, I think, gauge of should he be in or not. But that gets so complicated. It's like, where do you draw all these? Where do you draw all these? These voters from? What's the process? So yeah. I'm with you. It's confusing. I want to get it right. I want to get it right, but I don't have the answer either.
Well, and now the guys that are coming in the NFL Hall of Fame this year, you know, I covered them as a broadcaster, and every single one that's going in belongs in, believe you me. And then when I look at the list, and, you know, I always get a list every year that has like 40 players on them. Like, how are these players all going to get into the Hall of Fame? Eventually they should, because they all deserve to be, but we do have a recency bias. I don't care what anybody says. So if Drew Brees throws for, you know, 60,000 yards and, you know, he's coming out, he's going in on the first ballot. That means somebody else who could have went in the previous year or the previous 2 years is now going to get pushed back to the line even further because of the next generation of great players that is coming. And we all recognize how great these players were. So it's a weird dynamic for sure. They usually get it right. Most of the guys that get, I don't know about baseball, but I do believe most of the guys that do get voted in do deserve to be there. There's no question about that. And you and I, as ex-players, when we were on the field, and I'm gonna ask you a question. So you knew probably, you saw so many great pitchers, but there are probably a bunch of pitchers that you played against that may have only had 150 wins, but you knew their stuff was Hall of Fame level stuff. Is there an example of somebody like that is not in the Hall of Fame?
I think if you just tell me right off the cuff, I would say a Johan Santana for me, a Kevin Brown for me.
Okay.
Kevin Brown, absolutely. You, every time you face Kevin Brown, especially his L.A. years, his San Diego Padre went to L.A., it was the same reaction as if Maddox, Smoltz, Glavin, or Pedro was pitching. It's like, we got to go deal with Kevin Brown today and that heavy sinker, and he's just going to bore it in on my hands all night. And I'm going to try to find a way to stay inside this ball and hit something up through the box. But yeah, it's guys like that. Johan Santana, who he's younger than me, but he came on later in my career, the early 2000s when I started facing him. He had some injury problems, but I remember stepping away. He was a Twin, and I thought, this guy is something special. He's got something special that not too many guys I'm facing right now have. And it was the differentiant for Johan Santana. As baseball players, as hitters, we train for whatever your fastball is, and usually you can deduct 8 to 10 points for that breaking ball or that off-speed pitch, his number one off-speed pitch. When you start having the ability to throw 95 and can throw me a 75 mile an hour changeup, that's something as players we don't train for. And that's why it's so rare, too. You don't see it very often. You know, for my generation, it was a Trevor Hoffman changeup. It's like Trevor's throwing in his heyday, he's throwing 94, 95. But he throws that changeup and it might be 73 and it never gets to the plate. It's almost like that that cartoon you walk back in the day when he keeps swinging and missing. So those are the guys that come to mind to me. But yeah, definitely. And some guys didn't make it because of longevity, because of injuries. But yes, those are the two guys for me that I thought, I don't want to. It's every time I face Kevin Brown, I'd walk away and go, I'm OK with never facing him.
Yeah, there were two players that I know you know of in the NFL that both are in the Hall of Fame, both deserve to be in the Hall of Fame, but both had truncated careers for different reasons. One due to injury, that was Gale Sayers for the Chicago Bears. You know, he played a really small sample compared to other running backs, but everybody knew how great he was. They could see the physical ability. They could see the Hall of Fame talent. They could see how difficult it was to tackle him, but injuries unfortunately derailed his career. But fortunately for him, he did get into the Hall of Fame. The other one, of course, is Barry Sanders for the Lions. You know, he was one of two players when I played against him I was offense, he was offense, he was on the field. I would actually watch to see if our defenders could stop him. That's how good he was and how quick he was. But he ended up, retiring early. He was tired of the physical abuse that he was taking as a running back. But he was so spectacular that there was no way that they could keep him out of the Hall of Fame. So, it's players like that, guys like Bo Jackson, that you know that when you're on the field with them, that they are Hall of Fame type athletes and players that very few people have that ability that they had. And, that's what made them truly great. So some guys make it, some guys don't, but it's unfortunate that we still kind of hang on to statistics way too much.
You bring up Barry Sanders, and he's fascinating to me because as a guy that's never taken a snap in the NFL, watching him, is he the best you ever saw?
That's a hard question because he did things that very few players ever did, and you couldn't tackle him in a phone booth, as they say. He was so quick and so fast and just so naturally gifted with his eyesight and his peripheral vision and his toughness. There's guys like Eric Dickerson. There's, Emmitt Smith, of course. There's Saquon Barkley in today's game. I mean, there's just so many great. Earl Campbell going back today. Walter Payton going back today. Gale Sayers, we just talked about. And I'm sure I'm missing a handful of guys, but I would say they're all in a class by themselves. They're all the five-star athlete at their position. So, he's right there with everybody else, and that's why he was the first ballot Hall of Famer.
They always ask, for me, I look in my generation, and as long as I played, there's always one guy. There's one guy that stood out for me. It was always Barry Bonds, and to this day, I've never seen anyone even close. And I think if you asked every single person that ever played against him, they'd have the same answer. And I look at football and I always wonder, is there that guy? I played against Bo as a baseball player.
Yeah.
He was just as scary. He was so raw and almost like, oh, I'm just playing baseball because it's kind of my habit. Like we go golfing or we go fishing, Bo plays baseball. And I used to watch him come on the field and I'm like, I'd watch how he'd set up and I was trying to figure out, does he have a plan here? I don't think he does. I think it's one of those, here's a bat. This guy's going to try to get you out. He's going to throw it across the plate. And your job is to hit it as hard as you can that way. And I think Bo did it, but I was in awe of his presence. I've never had a man on the base pass. I never could feel a guy running like I felt Bo. So I could imagine on a football field, it was the same thing. It's like, this is just a different dude.
Yeah, so the first time I saw Bo Jackson was in 1983. I was at the University of Maryland. We visited Auburn to play them. And in pregame warmup, he came walking out. Of course, we all knew who he was. And I had never seen an athlete built like that. I mean, he had not an ounce of fat on him. He was all muscle. And he was just so thick as an athlete. And as a running back who could run like a 4.3 40 was ridiculous to me. And then, later on in the pros, we played him in a playoff game when he was with the Raiders. And this is the game where he hurt his hip. One of our linebackers tackled him from behind. And unfortunately, that was the end of his football career. And I had never seen an athlete even remotely close to him. And to be able to do what he did on the football field and the baseball field, and I just think it was his supernatural powers, was remarkable. And that's why I'll always say to this day, the greatest athlete that I have ever shared the field with or been on the field with has to be Bo Jackson.
I agree with you. And I played with Dion for a couple years in Cincinnati. First of all, what Shohei Ohtani's doing right now, I never thought in my lifetime I would see. It's absolute unicorn behavior.
But do you think he could run for 100 yards in a football game? I don't think so.
No, but that's why I have the ultimate respect. What Ohtani's doing, I couldn't even fathom doing. But these guys to play at the highest level in two separate sports, it's nothing my mind I can wrap it around. I couldn't imagine hitting a 3-run homer, jumping on a plane, and going out for a pass in the NFL, going across the center with the old rule, going across the middle of the field with the old rules. It's just not. It's something I can't wrap my brain around. So playing with these guys, I was always impressed. I played with Brian Jordan in Atlanta, who played two sports. D Deion probably the most notable because of what he did. And Deion was a pretty good hitter. And then, like you, I played against Bo just a little bit, but his presence was different than any, than not only Deion and Brian, but his presence was different than any other athlete I've ever been on the field with.
How about Dave Winfield?
I played against Dave. I think I played against, like, I was a rookie. I came into the league in 92. Dave was still playing. Ridiculous, but he played football, basketball, and baseball, didn't he? Yeah, he was my dad. He's kind of my dad's age, and that was his generation. He went to Minnesota. Dad was at Stanford. So they played against each other, I think, in the Alaska League. So Dad was telling stories of Winfield way back when. I got to see him play a little bit, but yeah, I think from an athlete standpoint, pretty impressive. But I still think Bo is transcends generations, if that makes sense. I think no matter what era you played in the last 50 years, everybody that talks, it's always Bo Jackson. If they encountered him and were on a field with him, I think that's kind of the census.
Yeah, I would agree.
Nonsense.
I'm definitely agree. Yeah.
You've been doing WFAN. You've been there for a long time now. You replaced a legend. Now we've got Boomer. You're a legend in this field. You know, aside from what you did on the football field, do you get to a point where you're running into people today and they know you as Boomer Esiason, you know, TV, radio star? And do they forget that you played? Because I'm getting to that age now where they're like, oh, Brett Boone, yeah, your brother's managing the Yankees, you know, your son works for the Mets, and you're getting to that age where, yeah, I played too.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because we do have interns in the summer, and we'll bring these summer interns in and we'll interview them on the show, and a couple of times my co-host will ask the intern, okay, who did Boomer play for? You know, what sport did he play? And the kids have no idea. All they know me as a radio sports talk show host. And I guess that's a good thing. That means I'm good at my job. And, you know, to be honest, right, you know, I grew up here in New York and I was a fan first. I was an athlete as a kid growing up and I played all the sports, but I loved the sports teams here in New York, and especially the Mets, the Rangers. And I was more a Giant fan because of my dad. And my dad made me a Met fan because he hated the American League. So when the Dodgers and the Giants left, he was pissed off and he made me a Met fan. So I've been cursed that way. But I was always a fan first. So when I got this job offer, I didn't know how it was going to go. And I didn't know necessarily it was going to be as fun as it was. But here I am 19 years later. And I don't think I've ever had a bad day in the studio. And that's saying something. That means the people that I work with, I love working with them. It's been relatively consistent for the 20 years that I've been here. I had one hiccup in the middle of it, and that's when my previous partner ended up getting arrested by the FBI for doing something stupid away from the radio station. But my new partner is just as good and somebody that I appreciate. And like a quarterback, you know that you got a good team around you. Why would you want to change any of it? And that's one of the reasons why I think I've enjoyed it as much as I have and why I've enjoyed this longevity as long as I have.
The New York background, New York, obviously big deal. Knicks win it all this couple weeks ago. You know, and I remember as a kid growing up in Jersey and when the Phillies won the World Series in 1980, I think the Sixers went to the finals. The Flyers went to the finals. The Eagles went to the Super Bowl. Being a New Yorker through and through, you know, you got the Giants and the Jets and the Yankees and the Mets and the Rangers and the Islanders. When the Knicks pull off what they pulled off, does that kind of add some pressure in the city? Like, hey, we need to kind of step it up.
Yeah. If they can do it, anybody can. Maybe with the Jets. I mean, like Leon Rose, the GM here, over 5 years, it took him about 5 years to build this team to get it to where it needed to be. And then they had a little luck. They didn't get injured in the playoffs and they changed their game. And there was a lot of unselfish, high character players on the team. And Leon Rose, the former agent who was turned general manager slash president, whatever you want to call him, really put a great group of guys together that I think he personally knew. And he knew that these personalities would fit and they would come together as a team and that they would be unselfish. So he is the architect of this team. And I think if there's more pressure now on the general managers or the president of operations, depending on which team you're talking about and how they describe their particular people that are in charge of all this. I mean, I would say there's more pressure on that group of people than there is on the coaches and the players, because everybody has seen what Leon Rose did to a franchise that has been in a state of morass for probably 20 years. And it had been an unmitigated disaster with the decisions that had been made as to who was running the team. So in 2020, Jim Dolan hires Leon Rose. Leon Rose takes him 5 years, gets the guys here that he wants. They're not really draft picks, by the way. These are all trades or free agent signings. And he built a winning team through the eyes of knowing who these people are, the players were. And after 53 years, that's exactly what it took. So there's pressure on the general managers and the president of baseball or football operations, if you will, to make the right decisions, to get the right people in here to give their teams the same chance.
Last question, I'll let you out of here. If someone came to Boomer Esiason and said, we need you to be the head coach of our football team, could you do it? Would you even consider it?
I couldn't do it. Not at this level. My college roommate, Frank Reich, is now the offensive coordinator of the Jets. He'd been a head coach for Indianapolis for 7 years, I believe. Then he was down in Carolina for about a half a year. Then he went out to Stanford with his buddy Andrew Luck and did an interim stint for Andrew last year. And then he comes back and he takes this offensive coordinating job for the Jets. And I'm like, why are you doing this? And just like your brother said the other day, man, you got to love it. You got to eat it. You got to live it. You got to believe in it. And you got to have a passion for it. And, you know, I don't have that part of the passion that your brother has or my friend Frank Reich has. My passion was to do other things away from the game, to be able to do an impact in another part of my life, which I was able to accomplish. But I could never do it now, would never want to do it now. I just want to sit in judgment of it, which is a lot of fun.
That's right. Boomer Esiason's Foundation. No, it's near and dear. You've been doing it for a lot of years, helping a lot of people, raising a lot of money. I saw your son Gunner on an interview. And by the way, April 6th, that's my birthday.
Yeah, I know it is.
It's my birthday. Yeah.
So yes, it's his too, yes.
Talk a little bit about it. Where can people check it out? Where can people be a part of it?
Well, it's Esiason.org is the easiest place. Obviously, it's a website. It's been up for over 30 years, believe it or not. I'll never forget when we first put up our website was, I believe, in 1994. So we've been up there for 32 years, which is crazy. But yeah, I mean, Gunner is doing exceptionally well. He was born with cystic fibrosis, a multi-organ disease. Lifespan at that point was a little bit over 20 when he was diagnosed in 1993. And here he is now at the age of 35, some 33 years later. He's got two kids. There was a major breakthrough in 2017 that saved his life, and 90% of the CF patients are benefiting the same from this same drug. Our foundation, in concert with the National Cystic Fibrosis Foundation, has raised hundreds of millions of dollars to try to eradicate this disease. We're not there yet, but the lives have changed for at least 90% of them, and Gunner is one of them. And the fact that he has two children, he's a father himself, has a great job up in Boston. I couldn't be more proud of my son and what he has turned into. And I know I didn't win a Super Bowl, but the day that I found out that the drug he was taking was going to change his life for the rest of it, and it was going to add many years to it, was the day that I realized that, you know, I was put here for a purpose. And that purpose came through, and it was one of the greatest days of my life, if not the greatest day of my life.
All right. Well, Boomer Esiason, I really appreciate you taking the time today to come on the Brett Boone podcast. For those out there watching, you can now watch the Brett Boone podcast. Check it out on YouTube. You download it, get it on the Odyssey app or wherever you download your podcast. Thanks, Boomer. I appreciate it. Until next time, keep it here.
All right, Boney One, I'll see you soon. Take care, brother.
Thank you.